Hello and welcome back to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep into the cinematic adventure of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
And I'm Calf.
All right. Welcome back, Calf. Welcome back for day two of this week. We are continuing along with this action sequence, and no funny quip here at the top for me. Just it's a lot of action, yep. A lot of fighting.
In my notes here, I just said that we kind of got left with a bit of a music lover's cliffhanger at the end of last episode, where we didn't have a resolution note for the bagpipe marching sound. We start this minute directly off with that resolving note, and we see, you know, Gurney and his men still just running in, you know, head first into this sword fight with a bunch of Harkonnens that are now, you know, landing onto the I guess you would call it an airfield.
His own airfield.
And it's just they're going at it, you know.
Yeah.
You see the two different army, I guess you could call them armies, just rushing into each other right as they're about to, you know, collide, we just get a big fireball on screen that cuts us off.
Yep.
So we don't actually see what happens.
I do love that. I think it was a great sort of cinematographic decision on you know, the producer's end and the director's end. That lit up the battlefield, right? So if you were in a dark movie theater, maybe you wouldn't see it, the two charging opposites. But that ship blowing up and the fireball going off and sort of lighting the battlefield, then you see the scale of how many troops are actually fighting between both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another purpose that it serves is that it leaves, you know, because we cut away from the action right then, it leaves everything, like the fate of everyone here, kind of ambiguous.
Yep.
To everyone. True. So we don't know what happens. And I think this is the last time that we see this battle. I mean,
this is the last time that we see this battle, and it's the last time that we see Gurney Halleck for Dune Part 1.
Yeah.
I'd like to just pour one out for for our rolling ugly man.
He'll be back.
Oh, yeah. I know.
07's in the chat.
We have part two. Yeah. But for a perspective of someone that maybe has never read the books, you know, because I feel like a lot of people got into Dune because of this movie specifically.
Yeah.
There's a lot of questions that those viewers would have had the first time they saw it.
Do you think anyone would have noticed at this point that we haven't seen Through Fear in like 20 minutes? Or ever again in this movie?
Yeah.
Or in the series?
Thufir's last... the last time we see Thufir is just when Stilgar and Leto are doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
Yeah. He was mentioned. Out. He was called by Leto, right?
Yeah.
How about security? Yeah.
Going out for his midnight snack. but yeah, this is the last that we see of Gurney Halleck for Dune Part 1.
And I guess Lanville as well. I mean, that's presumably Lanville would be kind of right there with him.
Yep.
So yeah. All right. Well, more to come on the Gurney Halleck saga.
Yeah.
To wait. If you're following the movie along with us, it'll be about a year and a half.
We'll see him again next
year. Maybe about this time next year.
Who knows? Just quick shout out to Josh Brolin for kicking ass in that role.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll continue
as,
to see
as he always does
when we do part two.
Almost every role of this has been beautiful. So
yeah, I'm trying to think, like,
I can't think of anything that he wasn't just superb in.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything. Nope. All right, cool.
Yeah, and then it moves on to a shot of one note I have here is immediately after that explosion, it sort of moves on to a shot of ships racing to land with the two moons mm-hmm. in the background, right? Yep. The Hand of God being one of them. So that was I love how Denny loves to scale. Like if I were to describe him in one word in his productions, it's scale. Right.
So he
loves to continue to bring the audience like look how much bigger this actually is. And this is one of those shots like, holy crap, look at how many Harkonnens are landing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, he's done that in so many of his movies. Like the one that's like most recent besides Dune to me is Arrival.
Yeah.
And same idea, just the immense scale of the ships that are in that movie. So yeah, he's so good at it. I don't know if they have the same cinematographer for Arrival as they do for Dune.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was. I mean, I feel like most directors find people that they really like working with, yeah, and they just kind of stick with that. I mean, I can IMDb it real quick, but
hence Josh Brolin, you guys, right?
You guys feel some dead air real quick. Hold on.
Yeah, it's all right. We have waxed poetically about the sense of scale that this movie brings. Yeah. And because that's something that you mentioned yesterday, that you hadn't seen the 1984 Lynch movie yet. Mm-hmm. But that is something that is not very present in that movie. Everything is like clearly shot on a soundstage, or it's like, or it's, you know, some models. And there are moments where you get the sense of like grand scale, but nothing to this degree.
Yeah, I really think Denis was probably the only one that could pull this movie off. And, you know, no disrespect to any other directors, but all his movies are about much larger than human scale elements. Even Sicario, right? When it was about interpersonal people, but he still presented Juarez and the scale of Juarez and the gang violence that happens in it. Hopefully I got the city right. I believe it's Juarez. I could be wrong.
Fairly certain. I'll admit I haven't watched Sicario in a minute.
Right. But so even his shots of the city and everything is just like, oh my God, this is huge. This is way bigger than I expected. And he loves to present things like that to the audience. And I think with Dune, like, you know, really putting the description of what's in the books to screen, I honestly believe he was the only one to be able to pull it off.
Yeah.
Before we get too far away from it, so I was wrong. There were different cinematographers for both movies. For Dune Part 1 and Part 2 is Greg Fraser. I think it's Greg. His name is spelled Greig. I'm just going to call him Greg.
I'm sure we'll hear if we're wrong. Yeah.
Arrival, the cinematographer was Bradford Young.
Okay.
And then I also looked up Blade Runner 2049 as well, just to double check. That was Roger Deakins.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But Greg Fraser, who did Dune, also did Rogue One and Zero Dark Thirty.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay.
So also fantastic cinematography in those movies, which makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
All right. I like this guy's oove.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. So we get these ships kind of landing at an angle on the some of them look like they were landing on the side of the palace. I don't know if they actually did or not, but it looked like they were just kind of landing at the same angle that the walls of the palace were on.
I think that was maybe just like because they're coming in so hot and so fast kind of thing.
Yeah, fair enough.
Because they were fucking moving. You know, we had the comparative shot of the ornithopter kind of flying into Arrakeen earlier. Mm-hmm. And then we have that same shot, but with these ships, and these ships definitely seem to be going a bit faster than the ornithopter.
Yeah.
Granted, at that time, the ornithopters weren't rushing to battle either. So, you know, I still think an ornithopter could very easily outrun these ships.
Lots of swooping aerial maneuvers. I like it.
Those poor, poor heart mollusks.
Oh, they're doing their jobs. They're doing their jobs. Then we get the shot of the Harkonnen troops entering into the palace. So we get them in their classic black uniforms, just walking in kind of in an unorganized manner.
I noticed that too.
Not very like regimented like we've seen the Atreides troops in the past.
So that... Are you reading my notes?
I'm not reading notes. I promise we take her.
That's the first thing that I had in my notes is that there's a very clear distinction in the training
and the organization of troops.
These two different troops had. And, you know, we've heard it several times through this movie, most recently from Peter DeVries, you know, saying that they were trained by Duncan Idaho and Gurney Halleck very clearly. Trained incredibly well with, you know, amazing discipline, because we see, you know, the Atreides soldiers just standing perfectly still in formation.
Yeah, with a rally cry to boot too, right? So they are they are very much in unison. And yeah, that's a distinction. The Harkonnens are sort of zombie like in their march. Just get the numbers up and then we'll win, right? Versus what looks like, if you look, you know, when you get to the overhead shot on the stairs, there's a handful of Atreides protecting the stairs to the palace. So,
yeah. What did, when Piter was talking to the Sardaukar folks a couple minutes ago, did they give like a ratio numbers, or did they just say you have the Harkonnens outnumber the Atreides?
It was just that the Harkonnens with the Sardaukar would outnumber them.
Well, no, they were saying that the Harkonnens
outnumber them.
Yeah.
I'm sure they do. But there was never any like, oh yeah, the Atreides have an army of, you know, 300,000 versus our million or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to rack my brain through the book and see, because like I have a vague memory of them actually giving some kind of number, like Harkonnen soldiers outnumbered 3-1 or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely a whole heck of a lot of them there.
Well, I mean, if they're not disciplined enough to have their shields on by the time they touch ground, you know, then
yeah,
who knows?
Yeah.
Though they were disciplined enough to at least put some armor on, whereas the Atreides, while they have their shield, are also just in their, you know, typical green, you know,
jumpsuits.
Yeah. But once again, when you're woken up in the middle of the night and you're going right to battle, you don't have time to put on your armor.
Right. Right.
And it's not that the Atreides don't have armor, because we've seen it several times. But yeah, no, it's definitely a very clear, distinct, hey, we just got out of bed, give me a second to, you know, rub my eyes real quick.
Interesting. On this battle, you do see shield effects on both sides. And so has everyone woken up at this point and actually remembered to activate their shields?
Harkonnens included.
Yeah. And, you know, quick, it's, obviously a chaotic fight between both sides. One thing that I did watch it again yesterday, just before I, you know, I came on the show, and I did notice that there's a lot more blue on the right and a lot more red on the left, which the left being Harkonnen and the right being Atreides troops. So it was sort of very telling, because the Harkonnen numbers clearly outnumber the Atreides, at least the Atreides troops that are on the stairs. But
yeah,
it was very clear and distinct that the Atreides are sort of slaying through them, right? Just cutting their numbers down. And that was clear with sort of the discoloration between, you know, the blue and the red being right to left.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That's such a quick thing. Like, you have to really be paying attention to notice that kind of stuff. And just in a normal viewing capacity, that's probably something that's like super easily
otherwise
missed.
You just see pretty lights and the cool sound effects.
Yeah, so that's that's just a lovely detail.
Speaking of some details and stuff, one thing that I noticed is that the Harkonnens use a different style blade than the Atreides do. So we talked a little bit back in the episode where Gurney and Paul are training on Caladan. Talked a little bit about some of the, you know, motivations for developing the Atreides fighting style from the I'm gonna get this one. I think it was the Filipino fighting style. I don't remember the name, and it's so far back in my notes I don't want to, you know, just waste time with that.
Yeah, 30 minutes to find it.
But the Harkonnen swords are much longer. And they have this thing where they're thinner near the hilt, and then as they get towards that last third of the sword near the tip, they get thicker, like an actual, you know, like what you would consider a normal sword to look like. So it's a really interesting design on those blades as well. I think partly just because they wanted to have another visual differentiation between the two different houses. But I did a little research yesterday into some of the concept art and everything for, you know, creating the design and styles. Keith Christensen was one of the concept artists for the movie, and he's got some posts online on his art station that kind of go over some of the evolution of the different houses, you know, armor and weapons styles and, you know, just their regular dress and everything. So it's really cool to like check out some of his stuff to see all of that. And if you're, if you want, you know, physical, you know, copies of everything, there's the Art and Soul of Dune books, which are available.
Yeah,
they're like coffee table size books.
Well, with, John, you know, my birthday's in real life coming up, but I guess in
your recorded birthday episode was
a long time ago. That's right. Dang it.
Too late. You're gonna have to wait. But yeah, no, it's Keith Christensen, and that's Christensen spelled all with E's, because there's like three different ways to spell that last name. But yeah, he's got a lot of really, really cool stuff that to check out online as well.
So this is the, I have a knit that I'm going to pick here.
Okay. Pick knits.
Yes. This is the first time, or the first, like, not a complaint, just kind of inconsistency that I've seen in this collection of minutes here. The speaking of shields and you know, this sword combat, the velocity at which these blades are moving does
way
not
way too fast.
It seems way too fast.
Yeah.
To be able, like, for the shields to be able to penetrate the shields. And that could just be chaos.
In fairness, chaos.
Yeah.
Dark.
Yeah.
Because it's nighttime and we can't see every detail. But
sorry.
I would agree, because some of the sword movements definitely seem very fast.
Yeah.
So if I recall, and it's been a while since I've read the book, well, it's since COVID, I guess. If I recall, there is a segment, and specifically when Gurney is training Paul, about how you strike with the intent of making sure that you slow down your weapon to pass through the shield. So I do wonder if there isn't some sort of martial art here where you break the momentum. You strike quickly to not have the defender time to react to the defense, but actually slow down your weapon fast enough to penetrate the shield at the last bit. Right? Think back to like sort of ancient like samurai movies and things like that, right? Where they can stop at a dime at the neck. You know, like, I could have killed you, but I didn't, because I'm that in control of my sword. I'm wondering if it's something like that in the training of the Atreides here.
Yeah, I think the line they use is like, it's slow on attack, fast on defense is something that they say in the books. I think they say it in the movie too.
They don't in the movie, but we definitely did talk about slow on attack, fast on defense.
Gotcha.
We see it in the movie a little bit when Gurney and Paul are sparring with each other.
Gotcha. Yeah, that very well could be that. It's just that the motion that I saw, like the swords and pikes flying at, I was like, that seems fast, but you're probably right. It probably is that discipline of getting to the shield and then still carrying the momentum forward, but not the velocity.
Yep.
Yeah, I feel like we, so in this moment, we also see not only Atreides soldiers with swords, but also with those spears.
Yeah.
I feel like the spear would be more effective because you do the quick jab, because we know that momentum, or the force from the momentum, is carried through, because we see Gurney just smack the shit out of Paul so hard that he like falls to the ground.
Right.
And then once you do that, then you slowly would penetrate with the spear.
Gosh,
I don't know. It'd be cool to just like ask stunt coordinators and just be like, hey, like,
yeah,
we have some questions.
Well, I'm sure there's a YouTube breakdown somewhere where it's like sword fighting in the Dune universe and how it would work. I'm sure you could probably find someone who is much more experienced talking about this 100%. I do have one note here that I called it out, and I don't know if it was intentional or not, but in the rally cry prep on the stairs on the Atreides, I thought it was a cool nod. If you notice, they kind of swoop in and out of each other. So it's like, you know, odds and evens sort of just interlacing back and forth. I thought that was very wave-like, which is sort of like a nod to their homeworld on Caladan.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
It's a nod to the waves of Caladan, but it's also a nod to their Greek ancestry too.
I noted it looked very like ancient Greek, ancient Roman, like that kind of fighting style, or like the legionnaire kind of fighting style.
Yeah. I like that water analogy. Though you only have two lines of defense here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's also because everyone's waking up. Yeah. And, you know,
they're a little spread thin at the moment.
It would be very interesting to see like the Atreides in like full prepared battle.
Yeah.
Operate. Unfortunately, we never see that though. So
Nope.
Unfortunately. Nope.
So, as they're fighting on the stairs, we get another troop ship that just starts to poop out some soldiers.
I've noticed that Denis really likes bird's eye view shots as well.
Yeah.
And it's not just with Dune, but it's with some of his other movies as well. We do see a lot more of them in Dune. But yeah, we get bird's eye view of these little white white armored guys jumping out of one of these transport ships.
Yep.
There was another thing on that bird's eye view that, if you noted, the Atreides numbers don't look thinned out at all.
No, they don't.
Right. No. And I love this. It will happen again in the next couple episodes, but I love this. I think Denis presenting us with, like, what's the theory called in comic books? It's like power scaling, right? So, you know, here you have a thimble of Atreides soldiers taking on a horde of Harkonnens with very minimal damage to their numbers. And what now we're seeing sort of level two, which is these white armored shock troops dropping down from the ships.
Yeah. And they just gently float down. Silently.
Very silently. Well, not for us, because we're hearing more Sardaukar throat singing as they're descending.
Well, if they heard the bagpipes from last episode out loud, maybe they hear the throat singing out loud too.
Who knows?
Is that like a real life bluff? You know, bagpipes for Atreides and throat singing for Sardaukar.
You just have a bard somewhere that's just fucking going crazy in the corner, just buffing everybody.
I love it.
Their presence is soon made known as someone shouts Sardaukar, Sardaukar.
Yeah.
We see them, the Atreides troops just, you know, get enveloped, really. I mean, they still have some Harkonnens in front of them, and we got the Sardaukar behind them now. And our minute ends right there.
Yeah. Reminded me of the scene from 300 where someone shouts behind and they all shout behind and they just turn around and reform the phalanx to the rear immediately. Yeah. It's a beautiful sort of like similar scene setup.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very heavy analogy right there for sure.
Yeah.
My only book note for this episode, is we get to see the Sardaukar in their white uniforms, and that is not how it happened in the books. So in the books, they were dressed as Harkonnen soldiers, because the emperor did not want his involvement to be known here. You know, if you have, despite the Sardaukar being great, great warriors, some of them are going to die. You know, that's statistics. Some of them are going to die during this fight. So if you have a Sardaukar dressed in the imperial white armor, that is a dead giveaway that the emperor had some kind of plan or involvement in this plan.
True.
Because he's the one who controls them. So the idea was that they dress in Harkonnen uniforms to conceal the fact that the Sardaukar were there.
Yeah, I think for the movie, obviously they probably opted for it such that you have a visual distinction between Harkonnen and Sardaukar. But also, I think in the movie, the expectation was that no one will be left alive to tell the story of what happened.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the purpose of that whole scene on Seleucus Secundus, on Second Salsa.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it why they didn't make that distinction.
Yep.
I think they easily could have, though, because that's just a couple lines of dialogue. And then, you know, having them look the same as the Harkonnens. But it does introduce another layer of, like, confusion. We as the audience wouldn't know, oh, shit, there's Sardaukar here now, because they would just be, you know, mixed in.
Why did they just spend a minute showing off, you know, the bloodletting ritual and, the very clearly distinct Sardaukar armor to then just hide them behind Harkonnen shit.
One question I had is, was that one battalion out of the three? I think I didn't understand what a Sardaukar battalion, how many troops were in it. Was that all three battalions dropping down?
So we did a little bit of, if you're comparing it to like U.S. military structure, a battalion is about 1,000 troops. So I would have to imagine that of those 3,000, you know, they're scattered out, you know, various places, or maybe are still up in the ships, you know, in orbit waiting to come down.
Yeah. So in the movie, I did, you know, the insane thing and paused it and went and counted a grid. There's 800 Sardaukar per battalion, three battalions. So we have 2,400 Sardaukar here.
Interesting. Okay. So I was way off. Yeah. Because we only saw like maybe a dozen dropping.
Yeah.
Yeah. This would just be one like contingency of, you know, like
this was a squad.
Yeah.
And we know too that there's, you know, population centers other than Arakeen on Arrakis.
Mm-hmm. It's a big city.
Yeah. And yes, it is a huge fucking city. So I imagine they, you know, just kind of split everyone up and just sent them in finding every Atreides they could.
Yeah.
And disposing of them.
But yeah, like I said, our minute ends right there before we can get to see any really action from the Sardaukar. They're just like looming right now.
Yeah.
Looming behind them. So any more notes on this one from y'all?
I don't have anything from me. Do you have your... is our continuation from from yesterday's episode the same, where none of this happens in the books?
Yeah, well, I mean,
other than what we just talked about with the Sardaukar being in Harkonnen armor.
Yeah, that's really the only book comparison or tie-in or notes that I wanted to talk about. I mean, again, we hear about this at different points, kind of scattered throughout the book, but nothing like concentrated like this.
Cool.
Yeah.
Kaf, do you have anything for us?
No. Excited to jump into the next minute tomorrow. So,
well, before we go, just wanted to, you know, plug some socials once again. You can find us on Twitter at Dune Minute. You can email duneminute@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at the Dune Minute. Otherwise, we'll be back tomorrow for a midweek Wednesday episode talking a little bit more about some Sardaukar as well.
As opposed to a weekend Wednesday episode,
You know, could be a third day or a fourth day of the week Wednesday episode. You never know.
All right, cool.
What is time, anyways? Days are arbitrary.
All right, well, I'll go. That'll keep me up tonight. All right, we'll see y'all back tomorrow.
See you.
See you.